Have you ever wondered why exactly it is that things usually sound better at home than they do on stage, in auditions, or even in lessons? It's easy to chalk it up to nerves or assume that you just have to practice more or get more performance experience. And sure, those things certainly are part of the puzzle, but a lot of times that's not really the true root cause. If you've been confused by the inconsistency of your performances, I put together a free 4-minute quiz called the Mental Skills Audit, which will help you pinpoint your mental strengths and weaknesses and figure out what exactly to adjust and tweak in your preparation for more consistently optimal performances. You can take the Mental Skills Audit online at bulletproofmusician.com/MSA. That's MSA for Mental Skills Audit. And again, it's 100% free, and it'll take just 4 minutes to get your results emailed to you as a PDF. This is Noah Kageyama, and you're listening to the Bulletproof Musician Podcast. Every Sunday morning, we'll take a look at a new research-based tip or technique to help you practice more effectively or perform better under pressure. And on the first Sunday of every month, I'll have a guest from the music, sport, or research world who will share their insights on how we can all be a little more awesome in the practice room and on stage. Today, I'll be joined by clarinetist and researcher Christine Carter and clinical psychologist Ellen Hendrickson, who both address the issue of perfectionism in the practice room. As in, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Or maybe a little of both? And if so, how can we navigate this line in the most effective way, not just for ourselves, but as teachers and parents as well? I think you'll find that this applies to many aspects of your life, both in and out of music. I hope you enjoy it and find it helpful. I came across an article recently which looked at American, Canadian, and British college students and found that between 1989 and 2016, perfectionism had increased, where essentially college students were beginning to put more pressure on themselves to achieve more. They felt that others were expecting more of them, and they in turn were also demanding more from other people around them. So that'd be one thing if perfectionism was really good for us, like vitamins. And there are some aspects of perfectionism that course may be adaptive, but perfectionism can actually be quite harmful and problematic, both from a health and wellness perspective, but also from a performance standpoint. Like anything else, it's easy to blame the internet or social media, but the research suggests that it's more complicated than this and that there are other factors, like education, for instance. So I wanted to explore that angle a little bit more today, basically to see if there are things we can do to offset whatever other influences we may be surrounded by and help both ourselves and our students develop a healthier, more sustainable, and more performance-enhancing approach to becoming the best that we can be. The smart thing would probably be to begin with an overview of perfectionism, like the different types and so on, but I'm actually more inclined to jump right into the specific thing that prompted this episode and see where things go from there. Namely, Christine, you were doing a workshop a few weeks back where you brought up a pretty classic practice strategy that I think we've all used at one point or another, which is to aim for some number of consecutive perfect repetitions before moving on to make sure a passage is totally secure and to restart the counter if at any point during that you make a mistake, where the goal is to avoid failure and the consequence of failure is to punish yourself with more repetitions. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but my impression was that you were worried this sort of strategy might be counterproductive and contribute not to more confident musicians and compelling performances, but more perfectionistic in a bad way and mistake-avoidant musicians and less compelling performances. So I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit on your concern around failure avoidance types of practice strategies like this, and maybe paint a clearer picture than I did in terms of what this practice strategy looks like in the practice room, and then maybe how it could be fostering the wrong sort of perfectionism.
Absolutely. So I know in my training as a clarinetist, I was taught to do exactly this, and I think all of us have had some version of it. So perhaps the most common one is to play something perfectly 10 times and you make a mistake and then it sort of wipes out all the work you've done and you have to start again from scratch and you start your repetitions again. And I used to practice like this a lot or with some variations of this and found myself getting very, very bored and then my mind distracted and then upset with myself that I wasn't focusing. And it wasn't until I started doing my doctoral research where I started looking at desirable difficulties and practicing using things like interleaving, for example, and spacing and variability of practice. So practicing in a nutshell in more challenging and more changing kinds of ways. I realized that that guidance was really not scientifically supported to just do things over and over and over again. So on the learning front, we know now that practicing in highly varied and challenging ways that might induce quite a few mistakes, actually, is much better for learning and retention than perfect practice. When we practice in a way that's perfect, we're usually not challenging ourselves in a way that the brain's going to be fully on board. Of course, people get very nervous about mistakes. And so what I make clear is that it's not about playing the same mistake over and over again and letting that be correct. There's a difference between making the same mistake over and over again and practicing in a way that's so interesting and challenging that some mistakes are going to happen and they're going to be different depending on what you're doing. So from a learning standpoint and my research standpoint, I became really interested in mistake making and challenge for their own reasons. You know, mistake making is being a part of effective learning. But I also began to question if we're really undermining process by saying that everything has to be perfect. So not only from a learning perspective, this isn't so effective, the science shows, but what are we saying to our students and ourselves if you do 8 repetitions, you make a mistake, and the 7 before don't count? So that became concerning to me. And I see that with myself, I'm definitely dealing with my own perfectionism. And with my students, it's so paralyzing. We're so afraid of making mistakes. And so I think anything that's reinforcing this idea that making a mistake is punishable and that it's harmful and that it erases good work before, I think this is concerning and something worth talking about. So I'm so glad that you're having the two of us here to talk about it today.
I wonder, Alan, if you had any thoughts, and you come at it, of course, from a different perspective slightly, but what do you think of when you hear what it is that millions of musicians are doing to themselves all the time?
Yeah. So perfectionism confers a lot of rule-governed behavior, that we have to follow the rules, avoid mistakes. And in my clinical practice, I try to move people away from rule-governed behavior and towards values-driven behavior. So I was struck by, Christine, when you were saying, is there a way you can practice with enough interest or enough challenge that making the mistakes is okay or worthwhile? And so a lot of what we'll do in the therapy room is to think about, what are the values that are driving me? How can I run towards what is meaningful and purposeful? And in music performance, I imagine that could be channeled into, I'm going to run towards perseverance or a resilience, and to practice and be willing to tolerate the negative emotion that comes from making some mistakes for the larger purpose of being able to express yourself or communicate with the audience or give a good performance. So we're trying to move away from the rules towards the values, and also to bring in the permission to make mistakes and feel bad in order to do something larger that we care about.
I wonder if you could both speak to your sense of where this tendency may come from. You know, aside from genetic predispositions, are there particular sources or influences that tend to exacerbate or create more of this tendency? And I remember coming across, when I was prepping for this, a 2004 study where the researcher looked at 12-year-old pianists and essentially asked them what sorts of things give rise to this anxiety that you experience in performances. And the primary reason for the anxiety that they reported was fear of making mistakes. So it sort of speaks to, if that is the central concern of ours in practice, it's probably going to be the central concern of ours on stage as well. And so, not to, you know, answer my own question, but yeah, I'm wondering what your sense is of where you see this coming from.
Well, from my standpoint, I think it's learned. I have a 6-year-old son and a 2-year-old son. And you see, especially with a 2-year-old, there's no fear of making mistakes. That's not part of his daily experience. He's making mistakes all the time, falling down, throwing himself at things he can't do. And that's what's hardwired. And that's what's ingrained to learn. So I think it really comes at a later point, because I think education is a huge part of it. It was for me. We're constantly being assessed, and with numbers attached to these assessments. And in the research I've done on desirable difficulties, it was so fascinating reading about how testing is actually effective for learning. So being forced to recall information creates learning. And how we could be using testing to create more learning rather than using it as an assessment tool, if that makes sense. So that asking students to recall information, if you give them a reading passage, if they have to recall what they remember from this reading passage, that leads to way more learning than having them just read the passage over and over again. But we don't tend to use testing as a way of increasing learning and recall and, you know, what am I going to remember? What am I going to forget? We tend to use it only for assessment. And as soon as that happens, I remember watching this Ken Robinson TED Talk, and he says, I'm going to paraphrase because I can't remember exactly, but this person might get 90% and this person might get 60%, and then we move on. It's like, but this person didn't understand 40% of the material, right? And so we're not using assessment to help guide learning. We're using it as a way of labeling, you know, you're doing really well, you're not doing well. And those mistakes are punishable. You get a bad grade, it has impacts on scholarships and so on. And I just think that's really been exacerbated even more in recent years. And I see the students who every year I'm on these committees for auditioning students, and the averages are going up and up and up. Like when I was a student, you couldn't have an average in the high 90s. That wasn't feasible. And now we're seeing like 98% averages. And so the pressure, I think, has gone up. The expectations have gone up. And I think students are just feeling completely paralyzed that if they miss that one percentage, then they won't get the scholarship. So I do think it's learned. I don't think we see this in the youngest of kids. And I'm sure there are also genetic predispositions. But I'd love to know what Ellen thinks about this.
Sure. So where doesn't it come from, I think, is the answer, or part of it. So it is a heritable personality trait. So there definitely is a genetic component, just like you guessed. And twin studies have shown that the heritability of what's called self-oriented perfectionism, so being hard on yourself, is 23% in boys, 30% in girls. So big chunk of heritability there. That said, it certainly, if we can think about widening concentric circles, definitely comes from our families. That might manifest in different ways. So we could see it modeled. So maybe we come from a perfectionistic family where the performance standards are sky high, whether that is academic performance or social behavior or any number of other things. It could come as a reaction to criticism, which could be the type that is too much all at once, like bullying, or too much for too long, which is just 18 years of being criticized by a family member, perhaps. It could be overcompensation. So perfectionism is not a diagnosis in and of itself, but it is a cross-cutting variable in lots of diagnoses, such as social anxiety, eating disorders, OCD, autism. So it has its tendrils in lots and lots of different challenges. And so sometimes we'll see like an eating disorder reaction. Like if I can't control my parents' divorce, then at least I can control the number on the scale. Or if I can't control something else in the trials and tribulations of childhood or adolescence, at least maybe I can win this audition. So there's lots and lots of factors that come from our families. And then just society in general. We get inundated with messages that we need to be our best self, or new year, new you. There's so many little subtle messages that we are not good enough and that therefore need to correct it. I think perfectionism is really a misnomer because it's not about trying to be perfect. It's about never feeling good enough. And Noah, the study you cited, Cran and Hills, it going up over generations certainly does not bode well for the maladaptive source of perfectionism.
It reminds me a little bit of what Christine was saying about number scores being higher. I mean, The numbers suggest that it is harder to get into a selective college or an elite college more so than it was. It's sort of crazy now what pressures and demands I think students at various ages are experiencing. I know with some things there tend to be like protective factors that can help to insulate or protect folks from experiencing certain things. Are there such things for perfectionism, things that help to insulate folks from experiencing more of that?
Yeah. So one is purpose. If we feel like we have a driving sense of what is meaningful and what we're trying to do, why we're here on this earth, to get a little grandiose about it, then we are less susceptible to mistakes or criticism or the thumbs up and thumbs down of others. We outsource our self-esteem less when we have a sense of purpose in what we're doing. Through a very different lens, going back to childhood, seeing non-perfectionistic behaviors modeled and being given those messages, even if our temperament skews perfectionistic, can be really helpful. There's a fascinating study from the Journal of Experimental Child Psychology from about 10 years ago, where both anxious and non-anxious kids were asked to just do a simple task. They were copying shapes out of a booklet. And the mothers joined them and were told to either give perfectionistic directions, like, make sure you do that right. Are you sure that line is straight? You might want to check that again. Or non-perfectionistic feedback, like, eh, it's okay if you don't get it perfect. Or like, oh, this is good enough, you know, good work. And interestingly, not only did the non-perfectionistic coaching lead to less stressed out kids, but it led to better performance. When they're drawing for rated later, they were judged as being more accurate and being of higher quality than the kids who were kind of nitpicked and controlled. So I found that to blow my mind, that stepping back and not putting the pressure on, not only just feels better, but leads to better performance as well.
And I think this relates to music too, that, you know, the purpose piece Ellen's talking about is so vital in music, that a lot of times this focus on perfectionism, I'll ask students, what does it mean even to play a passage perfectly, right? If we want to be spontaneous and making music, does perfect mean it's the same every time? Ideally, I wouldn't want my performances to be the same every time. And so I think focusing on that meaning and making music and expression and risk taking, you're also going to get a better performance. Because I know musicians hearing this, if we say, okay, perfectionism is not good for you and we need to let go of that, there's still going to be a fear of not being as good. And so I think for the musicians out there, myself included, that message that, no, that following a less perfectionistic route is actually also going to make you a better player, I think will be motivating for musicians to sort of reconsider these perfectionistic tendencies. And in other areas of music, the focus is already different. My husband's a jazz pianist, and in improvisation, for example, the focus can't be on perfect. It's just a very different set of values, as you were talking about values, and they have a different set of values. And I think we could use more of that in the classical realm.
Yeah, I'll often turn the tables on clients and say, well, how does it feel when somebody puts a lot of pressure on you, when the stakes are high and the pressure is on? How do you perform? And they're just like, oh gosh, that feels terrible. I usually, you know, will freeze or make mistakes just because I'm so freaked out. And so then we'll talk about, well, what happens when you do that to yourself? And by contrast, what happens when somebody encourages you and tells you you're terrific, contingent upon nothing? Then usually they'll say, yeah, well, I loosen up and I can focus on connecting with the audience or expressing myself or playing the music how I think the composer intended, as opposed to like, oh no, can't make a mistake. So yeah, lessening the pressure, paradoxically,
yeah,
performance.
Have either of you run into pushback? I'm thinking especially, Christine, with students that you work with or when you give a talk, because there's research on self-compassion as well that seems a little bit related to this. And they've looked at Olympic level athletes and elite athletes and performers and so forth. And it's been a little while since I looked at that research, but my impression was that there's a little bit of resistance sometimes, or fear really, at letting go of some of these perfectionistic or sometimes unrealistic expectations for performance or demands on performance. Have either of you run into pushback on that from students or other musicians? And how have you helped them understand that the goal isn't to be okay with subpar performance? The goal is ultimately to achieve more, but in a way that's actually conducive to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what Ellen was talking about too, about looking at how we talk to ourselves and how we would talk to others and how effective it would be. I often will talk to students like that. Like, if you were teaching a student right now and talking to them in this way, how effective do you think the learning environment would be? And without exception, they say, I would never talk to a student that way. And again, not just because it wouldn't be kind. So it's not just about the kindness piece of things, but also because that student would be frozen and wouldn't perform as well. So I think just bringing our awareness there, because these are ingrained habits. And I don't think students are, or we ourselves are engaging in this kind of self-talk because we think it's effective. Maybe sometimes that's the case, but I think a lot of times we're engaging this out of habit, and it's a matter of actually putting our lens on the type of self-talk, becoming aware of what we're doing, becoming aware that this isn't the most effective way to learn so that we can then shift the way we're talking to ourselves.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of pieces there. One is that there's a difference between expectations or standards and pressure that often I will very explicitly say, we're not going to lower your standards. We want you to have high standards, like keep striving for excellence, keep trying to do well. When we're done with all this work together, you'll still be perfectionistic, but it'll work for you, not against you. Again, this is a personality trait. We're not going to change personality. We don't need to, but we do want to lower the pressure, because that is the thing that is toxic. The difference between perfectionists and non-perfectionists is that non-perfectionists still strive for excellence. There's still those high standards, but there's not that pressure, and there's not that contingent self-worth. There's not that inflation of who they are and what they do. And so mistakes aren't personal. Or if we define failure as not meeting expectations, aren't personal. It's just a blip. So that's one. And then the other piece of it is that I think sometimes people who run perfectionistic feel like they have to really earn praise or positive self-regard or feeling good. There's really a conflation of performance and connection. And I'm encountering a lot of, I say kids, but I mean like people in their 20s. So the deepest wish of someone who struggles with perfectionism is to receive the basic human needs of love, connection, belonging, without having to earn it through performance. But I think some of what's happening in the Curran and Hill study, where perfectionism is increasing over time, is that we are conflating connection with performance and feeling that we have to make people like us by being good at something. That people will be my friends if I can keep up with them when we're skiing. Or my parents will, I mean, it's not this crass, but maybe sometimes, like my parents will love me if I bring home straight A's. There's a real conflation there. In therapy, we'll often try to separate those out to keep eggs in the performance basket, certainly, but really try to move some over into the connection basket so those are not one and the same.
I had a question going back to the parental role. All three of us are parents. We have kids at various ages. And one thing that just today, when my wife and I were walking the dog, I was thinking about is, I think when my kids were younger, it was easier to let them explore and stumble and pick themselves back up and so forth, because it felt like the stakes were not as high. But as they've gotten older, I think our parental anxiety about their safety and security in the future has started to kick in a little bit more. And implicitly, probably, I wouldn't be surprised if we are putting more pressure on them to not fail in ways that are measurable, grades, test scores, activities, and so forth, which again, probably isn't great for them, but it's more about us. And I wonder if you can speak to how does one navigate that, or should we?
That's hard. I mean, I have two middle schoolers and, you know, I don't do this perfectly. I don't think any parent does, nor can we expect them to. But I think one thing we can do is to try to focus less on outcome, like what college are you going to get into? Or, you know, did you get straight A's? And focus more on process, because ultimately we can't really control outcome. I mean, they can't even control outcome for some of these
things. That's right.
But we can control process. We can, and when I say we, I mean they, can control how often do they study? How seriously do they take things? Do they complete all their assignments? Like we can, I was going to say help them, but sometimes that backfires too. But to focus on doing the actions and doing the behaviors that can certainly influence the outcomes, not guaranteed, but that's what we can control. We can control how effectively we study for the history test, or not waiting to the last minute to apply to a summer internship. So even though that outcome isn't guaranteed, we can do it, we can control that process.
Kind of transitioning to teachers and the educational system, maybe more broadly, you know, without trying to make it seem like anyone's at fault, what are things that maybe just out of habit or intuition we do in the educational system or as teachers that maybe contributing to perfectionism without us realizing it? Because a lot of times I think our models over the course of generations are based in the Bobby Knights of the world and, you know, folks who we see on TV even motivating through these kinds of failure avoidance speeches. Are there things that you think we're doing or that you see or that you've noticed over the years, both Ellen and Christine, that maybe we should rethink or modify or tweak a little bit so as to try to be a little bit more, not embracing mistakes, but not contributing to increased perfectionism and avoidance of mistakes?
I would say that we actually have to embrace mistakes, that that's where we need to go in education, that there's been so much rewarding of perfection or getting things right and so much punishment in various ways, even if it's just, you know, a bad grade, that is a form of punishment in a way. A student sees that, they feel bad, that students are just paralyzed to try things. So maybe they're performing better in certain ways, but there's an unwillingness now to experiment and to try. And with new things, we're going to make mistakes. It's part of it. But even with old things, as musicians, we've been doing this, you know, professionals have been playing for a long, long time. And mistakes are still a vital part of the exploration creative process. And so I think really embracing the experimentation and creativity and trying things and failure and trial and error, it's again, not just for the self-esteem of our students. It's actually, you know, the science supports this, a more effective way to learn. So I think we're going about it the wrong way in education. And I think we could make some pretty big changes. But again, it's tricky. Do you remove grades altogether? I would love to see that at the university level. But, you know, we have some different opinions about this too. But I think grades can be problematic. And again, this emphasis on and rewarding of getting things right. It really interferes with experimentation and learning. So I think we could really change things to promote better learning.
Yeah, I run Perfectionistic and I have a sign, you can't see it, but it's right over there. It's like mandated my file cabinet. It says, mistakes help me learn. And yeah, Christine, I can't agree more that framing mistakes as personal and punishable is a real problem, and that ideally, we'd see them as opportunities or flexibility. My kid's school is fairly progressive and they've taken away the failing grade and replaced it with not yet, which I like. And so, and why if they haven't reached standards? And I think just from a 30,000 foot view, there's so much emphasis on mistake avoidance because there's so much emphasis on outcome. And so again, I don't do this perfectly, but I am trying to, in my kids or my clients, try to highlight and complement their personality and their values. Maybe yeah. It's not just that your kids get straight A's or win auditions, but maybe they're kind or curious or diligent or honest or have a strong sense of social justice. So they root for the underdog or they have a great sense of humor. And I think it's important to focus on the things that are not earned and that are not performance, just who they yeah. are, not just doing the things well, but totally appreciating them for who they are. There's a supervision trick for teaching new therapists, and it sounds a little woo-woo, but it says, okay, are you treating your client as a math problem or a sunset? And then what it means is, are you treating your client as a problem to be solved or a sunset to be appreciated? And has anyone ever treated you like a math problem to be solved? How does that feel? Yeah. And how does it feel to be a sunset to be appreciated? Nobody looks at a sunset and says, you know, if there was a little bit more orange there, that would be those clouds would be puffier if they just tried harder. We just appreciate it. We just say like, oh, wow, that's beautiful. Yeah. And that feels really qualitatively, you know, not just empty compliments, certainly personalized, but it feels really different from being treated like a problem to be solved.
I totally agree. And in learning, you know, when we see with students, this emphasis on right and wrong and this focus on perfectionism, it makes students not willing to accept feedback and to actually work on what needs to be worked on. Mm-hmm. So for example, most of my teaching is lessons, one-on-one or chamber coaching. But when I teach classes and students hand in assignments, they'll go to the last page and look at the grade and none of the feedback. So you like painstakingly take the time to write feedback and it doesn't matter. The feedback doesn't matter. And there's research to support this too, that this emphasis on right or wrong really makes students not actually focus on how to improve, on how to get better. And so in the practice room, we see this a lot with students. And I think with ourselves too, that if you play something and you think, was that right? We're not focusing on, did that have a line? How was the pulse there? It's not even objective, right? It becomes the subjective judgment. Right, wrong becomes, was it good? Was it bad? And I think most of the time students are in that place. Did that sound good? Did that sound bad? Instead of really getting into an objective place of, did I continue my error there? Or how did I feel about this leap? And so I work with students a lot on just making their self-assessments more objective and more actionable so that this sounds bad. It's hard to move forward from that. But I want to hear more line here. I'm going to use more air to do this leap. That's something they can actually change and measure. So the more we can get away from that sort of right, wrong, bad, good, which I think it just plagues us with perfectionism, right? Was it good? Was it bad? It doesn't actually give us a lot of information on how to get better.
Reminds me of the study that was done on John Wooden's coaching near the end of his coaching career, where, and I always ask this to students, and I ask it in a way that's deliberately misleading, or ask them, you know, what percentage of his 2,300 and so acts of teaching were praise and what percentage were criticism? And I say, is it like 50-50, 90-10? And they go with that and they make their guesses. And then at the end, I tell them, well, you know, it's basically 7-7, like 7% criticism, 7% praise. And most of the rest of it was purely instructive, kind of like you're saying. It's how to get closer to this goal you have for this, not whether it was good or bad. Maybe this is a good place to ask, Ellen. Sometimes I think maybe once upon a time, I'm talking about myself. There's this point of pride at being a perfectionist, right? Like you sort of pride yourself on having impossible to meet standards. And that somehow sets you apart from other people, which doesn't make sense when I look back at it, but it felt right at the time. I wonder if you can speak a little bit to this idea of a good or a bad perfectionism.
There is some literature on adaptive versus maladaptive perfectionism. Maladaptive perfectionism is where there's that contingent self-worth, that we are what we do and our self-esteem is outsourced to the reaction that we get from others or, you know, the things that we win or lose. And so there's too much overlap between performance and our self-esteem. Also, maladaptive perfectionism, the second pillar of that, and this is all, I'm using Dr. Roz Shaffran's theory. She's from University College London, and I really like her definition of clinical perfectionism. So the over-identification and the self-criticism is that second pillar. So the self-criticism that is harsh, personalistic, and disproportionate, like doesn't really match the mistake or whatever we're criticizing ourselves for. It's blown out of proportion. Whereas adaptive perfectionism, you know, somebody might be bummed if they make a mistake, but then they learn from it and move on. Or we certainly, with adaptive perfectionism, might have those high standards, but strive for excellence for the sake of excellence, not excellence because we're failures if we don't.
Actually, Christine, if I can ask, do you remember, and it's, I get the sense that all three of us were in process of trying to become less maladaptively perfectionistic.
For sure.
But Christine, do you have a sense of what that process has been like for you? I mean, can you describe some of it? Like, how did you go from being maybe perfectionistic in a non-performance enhancing way? And it ultimately, you know, it got you to a certain point, but then it held you back. Like, how did you take the next step forwards towards becoming more adaptively perfectionistic?
For me, it's a daily process. So I don't feel like I've figured it out now, and now the students have to figure it out, but I'm there. I don't feel like I'm there at all. What I feel like is that I'm in a place where I can accept that as part of my personality, and that every day I have to engage in a daily practice of practicing greater self-compassion and being more objective in the ways I try to get my students to be more objective. So it's not something that happens for me automatically. I really consider it a practice. And there are a lot of societal interferences with that practice, because when you are perfectionistic, even if you're maladaptively perfectionistic, we are often praised for our perfectionism or the outputs of our perfectionism, the products of our perfectionism. And so it's really a bit of an uphill battle and one that I just am like ready to engage with at least most days. Some days it gets the better of me, but most days I'd consider it a practice and uphill because society is still praising me when I'm maladaptively perfectionistic.
Do you have a sense of what some of the incentives or rewards have been for becoming less maladaptively perfectionistic?
I don't think there are a lot of external positive rewards for doing this work. I think it's more one of internal experience, that being less punishing. Because again, I think when you work long hours and workaholism and perfectionism are good friends, these things, again, they get praised. Oh, you work so hard. Oh, you're so dedicated. Oh, you're producing so much. You don't hear like, oh, great, you really took a step back there. Or, oh, you're working lesser hours. So I don't feel like there's much happening externally in society to give me that external reward. But for sure, internally, if we can do that work, it's obviously more, it's kinder to ourselves. So our daily experience can be one that is kinder. And I do think that it leads to better learning. So maybe not one that is exactly seen on the outside, like, oh, you're doing it this way, therefore your work is better. But one that I think we can notice, that when our self-talk is more objective and more compassionate, I think we do better work and have more of a sense of freedom and less paralysis. So I think it's a lot of internal results rather than external, which I guess is what we're going for in the end anyway. Right.
In other words, if we're hoping to get praised for becoming exactly a better perfectionist, we're not going to get that.
Exactly. But I don't know, at least in my experience, I haven't reached a point where it's like, okay, I'm good now. I've got this. It's really daily. What has been your experience, the two of you, with that? Do you also feel like it's a daily practice?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I feel like, again, you know, perfectionism is a personality trait. And so in coming to accept, not like as a resignation, but like really accept that this is just part of who I am, that I can sometimes use that when I need to, but also kind of calibrate for it, like realize when my brain is telling me, no, you just got to sit at the computer and work your way through this. Yeah. And I'll say, no, okay, this is what my brain does. And I know that if I go for a walk, even if it's like 15 minutes, I'll come back and I'll feel better and I'll probably actually do better. And so it's a matter of, well, mindfulness, quite honestly, like seeing from a distance and getting some perspective on like, no, this is what my brain does. And this is what my brain is trying to convince me of. And instead to go live my values and go live the things that experience and evidence has shown actually work, as opposed to just putting my nose harder to the grindstone. And then in terms of the rewards, I have found that, yes, certainly the internal rewards of this not being so punishing, but I found that when I am less perfectionistic, or when, like I was saying before, if I show people more of the mess and not just the correct highlighted answer at the end, I actually get closer to people. And so I get more support, I get more connection, I feel closer to my friends. And then also I find that I enjoy things more when I'm less perfectionistic about it. I'm like, it has to be this way. Then it's hard to have room for enjoyment there. But if I can be flexible and can take things as they come more, I enjoy them a lot more.
There are a couple things I wanted to end with, if that's cool. One was, Christine, we started off talking about that sort of classic mistake avoidance practice strategy. Is there an alternative that you often suggest to students or that we could embrace or start with?
Yeah, I mean, I think oftentimes that whole premise, so playing something many times perfectly, is completely counter to what I recommend students do, because I don't recommend repetitions in that way. I don't recommend trials like that of like, okay, play it again. Because for me, that's without purpose. So there's purpose in our life and our values, what Ellen's talking about. And I guess as much as possible in music, I'm trying to bring that into the music making. Like, what is the purpose of me playing through it this time? Why do I need to play it through 8 times? This time, I'm going to be working on X. This time, I'm going to be working on Y. I just played it. I noticed that the pitch wasn't quite right, or it felt a little unstable rhythm-wise. So now I'm going to work on that aspect. So the way I work in my own practice and getting students to practice is super problem solving based. And it's not at all like ticking off, okay, I did it this many times. It's really, you play it, you listen, you assess. And then from there, from that feedback, you decide what you're going to do next. So I think that is a starting place, like problem solving as a starting place, rather than thinking of just playing through trials would be my first advice. And then from there, as you know, Noah, I have done a lot of work on interleaving. And so alternating between materials so that the brain stays actively engaged. So you're not staying with something for your 20 repetitions or whatever, but working on it in a problem solving kind of way, moving on to something else and coming back. And that coming back is more, it requires more effortful processing in the brain, which is what leads to more learning. So it's less comfortable in the moment, but it's also more interesting. And so I think when we start practicing that way, when we're really used to lots of like high repetition practice, our lived experience is the discomfort experience. But now that I've been practicing this way for a long time, it's not uncomfortable to me at all. It's just more challenging and it's more interesting that way. So it's a little bit of a hump we have to get over when we're first practicing that way. So yeah, lots of challenge, lots of change, lots of different practice techniques, not just playing through things, but using rhythmic variations. And I mean, there's just so many different practice strategies, making up your own practice strategies, experimenting, trying things, recording yourself, listening back. What do I hear? Objectively, what do I hear? Not is it good or is it bad, but how is the pulse in this run through? How is the rhythm? How is my evenness? How is my line? Am I being musical? What are the dynamics like? And then trying to change one or two of those things, recording again. So it's what I'm recommending is just a more problem solving kind of based approach.
On a meta level too, because part of perfectionism is rigidity and just trying to do the same thing the same way.
Yes.
And so I think just even doing something different and trying to practice in a different way and experiment with that is that in and of itself is going to challenge perfectionism.
So. For sure. Being open to the present moment of like, what is happening? Yes. What am I hearing? And how am I going to make, like, what is the next step based on what I just heard? Instead of in advance, I'm going to plan all of the next steps, regardless of what happens in the practice room. And right. That's for sure how I used to practice, you know, as a student.
I'll talk to clients a lot about, you don't have to have it figured out ahead of time. Let's just try something, gather the data and decide from there and just do that over and over. So yeah, I appreciate your approach.
That's probably as good a place as any to wrap up, but I wanted to try one thing, which is, and it may go nowhere, but do either of you have any questions you wanted to ask each other?
Well, before a question, I would just say that related to perfectionism, I think everyone should have an Ellen. I really think that, you know, we talked about widening the perspective and having someone, because we have all these thoughts in our head and we think that they are real. Like we think that the thought translates to reality. And Ellen was talking about harsh self-criticism, and that's disproportionately connected to the mistakes that are happening. And I think all of us could benefit so much from having a therapist and Ellen in our lives who can help point out when we're making these criticisms that really don't have much bearing on reality, because sometimes we don't see it. And I think it's so important to have external observers who can help us become more aware of our thought processes. So that's not a question, but we need more Ellens.
Well, I think the role I play is also a teaching role. I think seeing what you do is exactly, it's the scene of the blind spots and pointing out the things like you don't have to have this planned out ahead of time, or let's see if this harsh criticism is working, etc. So I think having a compassionate and understanding person like you over their shoulder serves a great purpose. I guess I do have one question. What was your kind of transition point from leaning into the perfectionism to leaning away from the perfectionism? Like, was that just getting older? Was that a certain event in your life? What brought you to that point?
I guess there's two sort of different streams operating at the same time. And so one stream was really just wanting to be a better musician. And I was taking all these psychology courses. I was always really interested in psychology and working in this neuroscience lab. And just realizing that we use so little of what is known in music from cognitive psychology, sports psychology. And I just thought we could be benefiting in so many different ways. So I started learning about things like interleaving and wondering, why aren't we doing this in music? And so initially in my music practice anyway, it wasn't to be more self-compassionate. It was really, I wonder if I can get better faster if I try these different approaches, which are approaches that really embrace mistake making and challenge. So there was like that stream going on, and then a different stream of just trying to work on myself as we do, and trying to become more aware of my own thinking and more aware again of the fact that my thoughts are not actually equatable with reality, more accepting of my experience and just less punishing. So I think both of those things were going along at the same time. And I was able to start seeing that they're also luckily, but haphazardly somewhat related. So I'd love to know, Ellen, what you would like to see educators do more of. There's so many teachers and there's so much perfectionism. What can teachers do to help students with this?
It's hard to turn this into quantitative, do this. But yeah. David Brooks, the New York Times columnist and author, talks about what he calls two sets of virtues. There's the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. And so your resume virtues are your accomplishments. That's your performance, the things you've achieved. Whereas the eulogy virtues are the kind of person you are. And so often we focus, as you were talking about before, on the resume virtues. And so I would love, again, this is easier said than done, but to have teachers look more at that process. Yes. Like, what would you be doing here if you were being the person you want to be? Would you be worrying? Would you be ruminating about that audition? Or what would you be doing instead? And what would you be doing if you were living the life you want to live and living those eulogy virtues as opposed to focusing just on those resume virtues? I don't have that figured out yet, so I don't expect anyone else to, but that is a thought, something to aspire to.
It's great to aspire to that for sure.
There were several studies and concepts like interleaved practice that came up in today's episode. You can find links to all of this in the show notes of the episode, which is available at bulletproofmusician.com/blog. And if you'd like to explore this in greater depth, whether to get more out of your daily practice or to get better at managing performance pressure and shrinking the gap between what you can do in the practice room and what comes out on stage, you can sign up to join a new cohort of learners and educators for the upcoming 4-week Performance Psych Essentials class through Monday, October 9th at bulletproofmusician.com/essentials.